From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd, in for Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The White House could give the green light to release that memo as soon as today. I'm talking, of course, about the memo written by House Republicans that alleges the FBI inappropriately surveilled a Trump aide. The FBI has warned against making the memo public, saying it has grave concerns about material omissions of fact that fundamentally impact the memo's accuracy. President Trump, however, told a lawmaker after his State of the Union address on Tuesday night that he will 100% release the memo. Joining us now is Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Editor. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what do we know exactly about what this memo says?
Well, that's the beauty of discussing a secret document that remains classified. We don't know exactly what it says until it comes out, but based on what people have told us and our colleagues who've read it in Congress, it describes a Republican version of events in which a biased Democrat-run FBI in 2016 used unverified information from the infamous Russia dossier to get started with the Russia investigation by basically scamming a judge in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court to allow surveillance on somebody in the Trump camp because of flimsy evidence about his putative connections to Russia. A lot of this is partisan. It is the Republican version of events, but that is the case we understand that this memo lays out.
The Republican version of events, but the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Adam Schiff, said the memo was changed from what his committee voted to release. He now says the committee should vote again on it. How was the memo changed, according to Schiff?
Well, that's another great question because we haven't seen either version of it. We haven't seen the classified Democratic rebuttal that the top Democrat, Adam Schiff, says that he and his staff prepared, except to say that on Monday, the committee, which is controlled by Republicans who hold the majority in the House, voted along party lines to make their version public, but not the Democrats' version. And what Schiff said last night was that actually the document that they transmitted to the White House was a different one from the one the full committee considered on Monday, even though Democrats opposed it. And his point was that we have to be reading from the same sheet of music here and that if there are changes, the committee should have to vote on it again, including the Democrats. We've heard from the chairman's staff, Devin Nunes, this morning, and he said that's ridiculous. These are minor changes, just kind of grammatical changes, and nothing substantively is different about the memo.
It's also possible that the president or the White House could make changes before the memo is released, correct?
Changes or redactions. And part of the things that people should be aware of here is we've kind of sailed off the map in terms of law and procedure. Nothing like this, a congressional committee using its own authority to release classified material that belongs, quote unquote, to the executive branch, has happened in recent memory if it's ever happened before. And so there is no rule book here. There is no procedure that they typically follow. And that's why everyone involved is kind of improvising. This is provided for in Congress's rules, but it's never actually been done. So presumably the White House could redact some things or suggest other changes, but because this memo actually belongs to the House Intelligence Committee, even though it reflects classified material from the FBI and the Justice Department, they would have to actually release it or change it at some point when we get there. But nobody knows.
The Democrats who lead both the House and the Senate, or lead their parties in the House and the Senate, want Devin Nunes removed from the Intelligence Committee. Is that likely to happen, or is there anything the Democrats can do to stop this memo from being released?
No, it doesn't appear so. They have made very aggressive attacks this morning. The minority leader in the House, Nancy Pelosi, the minority leader in the Senate, Chuck Schumer, they both said Nunes has shown he can't be an honest broker here, that he's given up the privileges that he holds as the chairman of the committee. But Ryan supports Nunes. He supported him all along. He supported him and the Judiciary Committee against some of the requests behind the scenes that the FBI and Justice have made through this whole saga. And it's very unlikely he would lose his job now. And Democrats really don't have any more cards to play or weapons to fire besides rhetoric making these types of attacks to either get Nunes out of his job or stop this memo from being released whenever that happens to take place.
Many believe that this is really all about just putting a cloud over Robert Mueller's investigation into Russian interference in the election and possible collusion with the Trump campaign. Is that what this is all about?
Well, what Democrats will say over and over again is that the Republicans here are trying to dirty up the FBI and the Justice Department so that whatever comes out of their investigation in weeks or months, many people won't believe, because the groundwork will have been laid through all this political case that we're adjudicating now, fighting over now, that they're biased, that they're riven with Democrats, that they're out to get the president. And so whatever indictments Mueller might bring in the future or whatever other process comes out of that, right, people won't trust it.
That's Phil Ewing, NPR National Security Editor. We'll be watching to see if this memo gets released. Phil, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's take a look now at one of the new gene therapies designed to treat cancer. The most effective new treatment is called CAR T-cell therapy, but it's also one of the most expensive yet. It's not clear who will pay for it or what its price means for the future of cancer care. Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston is one of the few in the country to offer that treatment. Reporter Richard Knox has our story.
I'm a cancer patient. I was diagnosed with lymphoma back in 2006.
Barbara Kearney of Boston was the very first to get CAR T-cell therapy at Mass General since it was approved by the FDA. She'd already been through four different cancer regimens. None of them worked. So she was eager to try the new therapy her doctor told her about, even though it can cause life-threatening side effects.
I'm not afraid of dying at all. I know where I'm going.
Do you feel hopeful right now?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
I don't have a crystal ball, but with no further therapy, her life expectancy would likely be measured in weeks to months at most.
That's Dr. Jeffrey Barnes of Mass General. He's Barbara Kearney's oncologist. He says CAR T-cell therapy could give patients like Kearney a better chance at cancer-free remission or even a lasting cure. So on December 11th, doctors infused about 160 million CAR T-cells into Kearney's veins. They hope these tailor-made cells would trigger her immune system to kill every last cancer cell and hang around to attack any that reemerged. A study published in December found the treatment eliminated all signs of cancer in more than half the patients, and 40% were cancer-free more than a year after getting a single CAR T-cell infusion. Only 7% of patients treated with older drugs get that kind of response.
This is a game-changing technology where someone has a chance of improvement of 5%, and to be able to offer them 75 or 80%, it's a
big leap.
It's a huge leap.
But CAR T's success comes at a staggeringly high price, somewhere between $750,000 to $1 million to treat a single patient. Barnes breaks down the cost.
The ballpark figure just for the product itself is $375,000. That does not include monitoring prior to the infusion, PET scans to monitor the response of the disease, the need for ICU stay, antibiotics, neurologic evaluations, MRIs.
And these patients require some of the highest doctor-to-patient and nurse-to-patient ratios in the hospital. Mara Bloom is director of the Mass General Cancer Center. She says the hospital isn't entirely sure how CAR T-cell therapy is going to be paid for. Meanwhile, last-ditch patients are lining up for it.
When they get to us, they failed two lines of treatment. So we have to make decisions very quickly. We can't wait.
So Bloom says Mass General is forging ahead. The hospital's negotiating with insurers on a case-by-case basis. Medicare, the most important payer, must by law cover FDA-approved cancer drugs, but Medicare has yet to say how much it will pay for CAR T.
This type of price tag is not sustainable for the long term. This will be very tough.
The big picture implications are sobering. If all the roughly 7,500 lymphoma patients who could benefit from CAR T-cell therapy got it, the national price tag could be nearly $6 billion. That's more than the entire health budget of many countries. Dr. Peter Bach heads the drug pricing lab at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City.
CAR Ts are in a pack of new drugs that companies have now realized they can charge $500,000 for or $1 million for. That's how profit-seeking companies work. That's capitalism.
The small company that developed the CAR T-cell treatment Barbara Kearney got was snapped up by pharma giant Gilead Sciences last summer for nearly $12 billion. A Gilead spokesman says the high price of its CAR T-cell drug is justified because it's 7 times more effective than older treatments for advanced B-cell lymphoma. He says the price was set after doing market research with insurers, government payers, and cancer centers. But Peter Bach questions whether a cancer drug or any drug should cost that much.
That is $500,000 being taken away from something else, whether it's treating people who are addicted to opiates or making sure that patients get their medications for HIV or making sure that kids with asthma have adequate control of it so they can go to school.
The problem will become more acute if Congress cuts back on Medicare, Medicaid, and Obamacare insurance subsidies to offset the tax cuts it recently enacted. And still more urgent as researchers continue to devise ever more costly ways to treat the more common lung, breast, prostate, and colon cancers. Meanwhile, the story of Barbara Kearney is a painful reminder that a high-priced treatment does not come with a guarantee. After suffering severe side effects, Kearney died on December 29th. She was 71. For Here and Now, I'm Richard Knox.
On February 9th, the Winter Olympics will open with a dramatic ceremony from the brand new Olympic Stadium in Pyeongchang. But that stadium will be used only 3 more times before it's decommissioned. South Korea could spend nearly $13 billion hosting the Games, and some people there are asking if it's worth it. We're joined now by Judith Grant Long. She's an associate professor of sport management at the University of Michigan, and she's studied Olympic infrastructure after the Games. Professor, welcome.
Happy to be here.
The Olympic Stadium in Pyeongchang will be used 4 times at a cost of up to $100 million. 4 times. What do you think about that?
Well, I was talking to a colleague who is working in sport management in Seoul, and he equated it to $25 million a use or $10 million an hour, which is really a surprising metric. It's not so unusual to see temporary facilities used in the context of the Olympics, but this moves the needle towards disposable facilities. And I think the cost of this particular venue at approximately $100 million is really making people sit up and take notice about the costs associated with building venues that are really not used for an event even.
It's a 35,000-seat stadium. The population of the county is barely bigger than that. They just don't need a stadium of that size. And so I guess the question is it worth it? When the games are over, will Pyeongchang be able to say it was worth it to build that stadium?
Well, I think that's the question on everybody's mind. Part of the thinking of the province of Gwangju was to create a new tourist cluster. And this is not a dissimilar idea from what they were thinking with Sochi and what existed already in Vancouver 2010. The challenge is, A, there's only about 40,000 people, as you mentioned, in Pyeongchang County. The stadium seats 35,000, so you effectively have to have the kind of attendance that you get at Friday night football in Texas to get that stadium used even on a single event basis. The other issue with the success of this particular strategy in that location is that South Koreans at this point in time are not particularly a winter sport people. Mm-hmm. So the idea of creating a tourism strategy that's based on winter sports, skiing and so forth, has not necessarily been a well-received idea from an economic development point of view.
To that point, there is a plan to just completely tear down the downhill skiing course and just convert it back into nature. And this just tearing down the infrastructure wholesale has been a model in some other places. I think France did it in Grenoble in 1968. They did it in Albertville in 1992. Is just totally deconstructing the infrastructure a good idea?
Well, so this is where we get into this idea of temporary facilities. The challenge is that when you build a venue, temporary or not, there's a lot of labor involved. If you want to make it temporary, there's almost the doubling of the cost of that labor to take it down. Mm. And then if you want to try and recycle the bits and pieces from the stadium, you can either try and sell them into the supply chain in the sort of domestic construction market, or there were even fanciful ideas at one point about taking the bits and pieces, the seats and so forth, and putting them in storage and then shipping them, you know, to the next host, you know, really recycling the venues. Of course, that turned out to be incredibly cost prohibitive. So now the thinking is, if the cost of building the venue cannot be recovered through its subsequent operations, then why not just treat it as a sunk cost, demolish it, and then have the site to be able to do something completely different with.
Amazing. 2016, Rio de Janeiro, Olympic Games, big problems with the soccer stadium there. They invested tons of money into that. It turned into a nightmare. Another example, 2004, the Athens Games. There was a plan to turn the Olympic Village into public housing. Didn't work out. Of course, Greece had terrible financial problems afterwards. What is the best strategy, in your opinion, for these cities that get the games to deal with the potential white elephants that are left over?
Well, I think that cities that bid for the Olympic Games need to be very, very wise about what it is they're trying to accomplish from the outset. Part of the problem with host cities is that they very often have the planning process co-opted by politicians, the construction industry, mm-hmm. and so forth. And the planning process gets overridden by a different set of interests, which moves capital to locations that aren't necessarily best for the city in the long term. So what you want is a planning process to guide the construction of venues in a way that works for the city, as opposed to the venues to then subsequently drive the planning process.
Do you think we'll ever get back to the days when the Olympics are a more modest event, or at least maybe recycling cities that have already hosted them?
Yeah, I've done a lot of work, and actually I have a book coming out shortly about this very issue, about what really are the best paths forward for the IOC as well as host cities. And right now the IOC has basically sequestered itself for the next until 2025. They don't have to announce a new host for the Olympic Games. And so they are in sessions really trying to reimagine what might be an alternative going forward.
Because they're feeling the pressure.
Yes, they are. Well, this is why they announced the hosts of 2024 and 2028 to relieve themselves of the pressure of having to go through the host city selection process. So I think what Thomas Bach and the rest of the IOC members are really trying to do right now is figure out what is a sustainable path forward. And it's either a single site, a set of permanent sites, or really recalibrating the games around a much more modest idea.
That's Judith Grant Long, Associate Professor of Sport Management at the University of Michigan. Judith, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, now to another big game. The Super Bowl is this Sunday in Minneapolis. It's the defending champions, the New England Patriots, against the Philadelphia Eagles. Now, the Eagles have never won a Super Bowl. The Patriots, they have won a lot of them. Mike Pesca is here and now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Look, let's start with the quarterbacks, because that's what this game is really about, right? You've got one of the best in NFL history in Tom Brady and the Patriots, and then the Eagles have Nick Foles, a backup.
Well, he's a backup this year. He's a backup to Carson Wentz, and when Carson Wentz went down, it was thought that the Eagles' chances went down with him, and there wasn't much proof to the contrary during the regular season. But then in the playoffs, Foles, who was a starter a few years ago and actually put up statistically an excellent season then, Foles had a better playbook and he was able to be utilized in what's called the run-pass option where, you know, he gets to read a defense and decide whether to run the ball or hand it off or throw the ball. So a better offensive game plan played to his strengths, and Nick Foles showed that he can be an effective NFL quarterback. Now, we're in the Super Bowl, and as you said, we're against Tom Brady. I really think it's hard not to argue he's the greatest of all time. So we have the greatest of all time versus a guy who's proved he can be an effective NFL quarterback.
Not only that, you have a team, and look, I'm not rooting for the Patriots. I'm just saying they've been here before. This is their eighth Super Bowl in the last 16 years. If they win, it will be their sixth championship. How do you compete against that?
Well, here's a stat. I'll credit it to NFL Research. They put this one out. They looked at the entire Eagles roster and add them all up. All those players have eight Super Bowl appearances among them, and that is, as you mentioned, as many as Brady has. So experience will not be on the Eagles' side, but experience doesn't always win. An excellent defense can win. The Eagles have a better defense than the Patriots have a defense. Do the Eagles have a better defense than what the Patriots can throw on them on offense? And this is, we say experience, and I think we use that as a little bit of a shorthand for, you know, they won't be mentally flustered. I don't really think that that's where experience will play in. Mm. I just think that the Patriots coach, Bill Belichick, for him, this is something that he's gone through before and that he's gone through with great success. And he knows exactly what he's doing. And he knows, for instance, there's a reason, even if you look at some of the demerits of the Patriots, the fact that, interesting stat, they've never scored in the first quarter of a Super Bowl. Hmm. But there's a reason for that. And he knows, Bill Belichick knows, that you could lose a game in the first quarter with turnovers and getting behind, but you can't win a game. So he knows exactly how to pace his team.
Yeah.
They've done it before so many times.
Come back in like the final seconds like they saw you saw in the championship game, yeah.
Right, right. So if Philadelphia wins, they will have to, I'm not going to say get lucky, but you know they will not catch Bill Belichick and Tom Brady napping. They will have to beat the Patriots. The Patriots will never beat themselves.
And Mike, another big question off the field, will people be watching this game? NFL ratings have been down.
Yes, but they'll be watching. It's the number one TV show and has been for years and years and years. It's culturally dominant. I think we are living, though, in a more diffuse culture. So what was culturally dominant once in the age of Walter Cronkite and the last episode of MASH is not quite so dominant as it is today.
All right. That's Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
Oh, Canada.
That is the Canadian National Anthem, a limited edition because the anthem is about to change. The Canadian Senate voted yesterday to make the anthem gender neutral, which means changing this line.
In all our sons' command.
In all our sons' command will change to in all of us' command. This isn't the first time Canada has tried to make the change. Since 1980, there have been no fewer than 12 attempts. The bill is now awaiting a formal royal assent from Canada's Governor General. Senator Chantal Petitclerc, who is a former Olympian, says she's happy Canada's athletes will be able to sing the new version of the anthem at the upcoming Olympics in South Korea.
I'm jealous. You know, I had the privilege to be on the podium many times in my life and never had the chance to sing in All of Us Come In. It's an amazing moment.
And by the way, while the English version of the anthem is changing, the French version is already gender neutral. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Ophira Eisenberg. Join me on NPR's Ask Me Another as we challenge contestants and celebrities to nerdy word games, music parodies, and punterful trivia. Find us every week on the NPR One app and wherever you listen to podcasts.
The U.S. stock market continues to amaze, with the Dow Jones Industrial Average still hovering around 26,000. But are we in a bubble? Well, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan, thinks so. Here he is speaking yesterday on Bloomberg TV.
I think there are two bubbles. We have a stock market bubble and we have a bond market bubble. I think in the end of the day, the bond market bubble will eventually be the critical issue.
Joining us now is Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Jeremy.
And let's go through these bubbles that Alan Greenspan thinks we're in, starting with the stock market. How worrying should that be?
We should totally pay attention when someone like Alan Greenspan talks about being in a bubble. And by the way, I'm going to date myself, and I was in the audience when he made that comment covering him. I think we've learned through all the pain of the dot-com bust and housing crisis that we should really take a look at that when someone is saying there's a bubble. But I will say it's also important to note that there are differences. You know, no cycle acts like the previous one. And there are a lot of analysts out there who disagree with him and say stocks, yes, maybe they've rallied too far too fast, but they stop short of calling it a bubble. So there's a debate out there.
And the comment that you're talking about is when he said irrational
exuberance
talking
yes.
about the tech industry.
That's right. And he, by the way, it took three more years for that to come to fruition. So, and a lot of money was made in that time. So it's very hard to time the top of a market, but it just goes to show you can sort of start to see things forming, but it's hard to call the outcome and to know exactly how it's going to play out. So the warning should be taken seriously, but maybe not, you know, verbatim as a get out today type thing.
And what about the idea of us being in a bond bubble, that the bond market is the bigger issue, according to Greenspan?
Yeah. And that is because we've been having all of this cheap money from central banks pumped into the system, pushing down interest rates. And you know, there's a feeling and an understanding that that has to come to an end. The reason why he says it's the more critical thing is a stock market decline hurts shareholders, but bond market bubble bursting would impact everyone because it pushes up interest rates maybe quickly, and that affects everything, your mortgage, your credit card, business loan, car leases. So it has a much broader effect on the economy. High rates are good for savers. There is a silver lining, but bad for borrowers. And last time I checked, we're a nation of borrowers. Guilty, myself.
Well, and the rates would have to go up so much to even make a difference in your savings account at this point. You make, you know, no money yeah. at all by keeping your money in savings at the moment. I want to ask you about one other thing, Maggie, a stock that has been doing pretty badly recently, and that would be General Electric. Now we're hearing that they might even be removed from the Dow and replaced with who else? Amazon.
Oh, sign of the times, right? And this is, I mean, it's been doing badly in a market where everything has been doing well, right? So that really underscores the problem. Listen, the answer to what its problems are as complicated as the company itself, but that's really what it is in a nutshell. They got too big, too, you know, they bought too much at the wrong time, didn't see that they should get out of it, and they were overconfident in their ability to manage it. Interestingly, Jeremy, a lot of people blame Jeffrey Immelt for that the CEO stepped down in August. I think the truth is probably that it goes back further than that as well. John Flannery is the man who's tasked with turning this baby around. He has said all options are on the table. We don't know what he's going to sell, if he's going to sell something, but it does seem like they're going to try to get smaller and simplify things. Hopefully that's enough to get their mojo back. This is a legacy company.
That's Maggie Lake, who hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. Maggie, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And on a week that President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address, let's take a look back at the history of the speech.
Mr. Vice President, Mr. Speaker,
members of the 88th Congress,
my colleagues in the Congress,
distinguished members of the Congress, honored guests, and
my fellow Americans,
I am proud to say to you
that the state of this old but youthful Union,
that the state of our Union,
the state of our Union,
the state of the Union is strong
because our people are strong.
We're joined now by Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow. They're historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, welcome back.
Thank you.
Good to be back.
Well, look, the U.S. Constitution says that every president shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. But, Ed, I gather it does not go all the way back to the beginning of the Republic.
Well, it started off in a way much like today. George Washington literally gave an address, 1,089 words, about five new form long tweets. And then John Adams did that. And then Thomas Jefferson said, you know, I don't think I want to do that. I'm not that great a speaker. Here, I'll just send over some words. You guys read it. And that's what happened all the way through the rest of the 19th century.
Well, Thomas Jefferson thought that an in-person speech to Congress was a little too much like giving a king's list of orders. He didn't want the pomp and circumstance of such an event, it sounds like.
Well, and another great concern is that this would be a demagogic appeal to the people, to the rabble. You're supposed to be talking to Congress. You're not supposed to be making campaign speeches. And so that was the other great concern. It was either too monarchical
and,
on one
and you
side
were
or too
talking
much
to
rabble.
Congress because they didn't have C-SPAN in those days.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So, yeah, it was quite different, in other words, Peter, from what we have today.
So when did things change from that annual statement, that document that he might have given to lawmakers, to the State of the Union address as we more likely know it today?
Let's take this one step at a time, Peter. I mean, it changed to presidents talking to Congress directly with Woodrow Wilson in 1913. And that's not surprising because you now have what political scientists call the modern presidency, more powerful presidents even during peacetime. And Wilson went to lay out his legislative agenda for Congress. Now, not everybody did that, but most presidents began to talk to Congress directly. The next big change, really, is television. Truman has the first televised address after World War II, but You know what I want to stress, Peter, is even when those 19th century presidents, those non-entities, Ed, were issuing those really dry reports that had all kinds of numbers and everything, they were almost like accounting statements, they actually managed to say some really important things. And I'm sure that Ed can think of one of them.
Well, here's a bonus. I can think of two. The first is the Monroe Doctrine, 1823, in which he announces, you know, we're basically going to take responsibility for the hemisphere. So don't be sending all your wars over here. We're going to take care of that.
Right. That was saying basically it was opposing European colonialism in the Americas.
Yeah, and kind of staking out American colonialism in a way.
So that we could do it ourselves, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then Abraham Lincoln, of course, some of his most memorable lines are actually in his annual addresses to Congress rather than in other speeches that he's giving. And so you think right after in the Emancipation, he speaks at great length about what it would really mean if the enslaved people became free. Hmm. And then the next year, he gives the Gettysburg Address, which we are so thrilled that he only used 276 words. But then he uses thousands and thousands of words just 3 weeks later to tell Congress about all the details of things. So that's what we need to understand, is that the annual address to Congress really used to fulfill kind of bureaucratic functions. Even as it's grown in visibility and in audience, it's sloughed off away a lot of its content along the way.
Hmm. When did the applause become such a thing?
Let me applaud that question, Peter. The applause becomes a big deal after these go prime time on television. And really during the Reagan administration, there's a terrific anecdote about Reagan's 1982 State of the Union talk, and a Democratic congressman noticed that, like, the applause was almost synchronized. So he kind of walks across the aisle and gets a copy of the advanced notice that Democrats and Republicans got, and it's the same as his, except applause. Applause. They wrote in the applause lines for the Republicans. And so Tip O'Neill, the Democratic Speaker of the House in 1983, gets his advance copy, and the Democrats write in their one applause line for Ronald Reagan when he happens to say, "We need the federal government to do something." And they jump on that. He said, "We need the federal government to stimulate the economy." They jump on that and erupt in applause. And Reagan was actually kind of thrown a little off stride by that. But that's when applause really begins breaking out. And now you can count on at least 80 interruptions for applause.
You make a very good point, because the applause becomes very much a part of the telecast. And that gets to this idea that the State of the Union has changed very much over the years because of technology. Twitter, for example, said President Trump's first State of the Union this week was the most tweeted about in history. Now, I guess Twitter hasn't been around for very long.
Right.
But it did say 4.5 million tweets using the hashtag SOTU, S-O-T-U, or joint address. So just another example of the way that technology comes into play during these speeches.
Yeah, because Twitter is actually displacing television. People don't gather around the hearth to watch that anymore, but rather on social media where they can respond immediately.
But the other thing I'd say is some real changes in the way we think about the presidency have driven more opportunities for interaction, whether it's through TV or whether it's through Twitter. Ever since Jimmy Carter ran on a populist platform, presidents, starting with Ronald Reagan, have been looking for ways to actually show regular people. And it was Ronald Reagan who was the first to invite a guest and turn to that guest in the audience. And if you watch President Trump's State of the Union, I lost count, but he had numerous guests, and he would turn to them, and there'd be even a little interaction, and the cameras would show those guests.
Right, the boy who planted American flags at cemeteries for veterans, the North Korean defector. They are good stories.
They are good stories, and they're interactive within this set piece. And I do think that's been one of the real changes since the 1980s for both Democrats and Republicans.
the response to the State of the Union. Now, the opposing party loves the opportunity to have a few moments in the spotlight after the president gives his State of the Union address. When did that start?
That started in the mid-1960s, and it was absolutely synonymous with moving the State of the Union to prime time. And it was Johnson who was now in prime time as president, and those Republicans who at that point demanded equal time under the Fairness Doctrine. You had to give both sides. But that raises another big difference between the State of the Union today and even then, Peter. It was much less partisan then for a very simple reason. Both parties had conservative and progressive wings. So you could be a Lyndon Johnson, a Democrat, a reasonably progressive Democrat on social issues, and get a lot of applause from moderate to progressive Republicans. You could be a Richard Nixon, more conservative Republican, and get quite a lot of applause from Southern Democrats. The nation was not divided as starkly along blue and red lines.
When did it become a requirement that those rebuttals have an awkward moment?
When they invented bottled water.
Marco Rubio, 2013. We know President Trump wouldn't let him forget about that during the campaign. Ed Ayers and Brian Ballow, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Another week of turmoil in Kenya. The country's high court today ordered the government to end its shutdown of three TV stations. They went dark because they defied a government order not to broadcast an event on Tuesday where opposition leader Raila Odinga declared himself president. He is still protesting Uhuru Kenyatta's election last year. Joining us now is NPR's East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta. He's in Nairobi. Hi, Eder.
Hey, Jeremy.
And what did the court say in its ruling today?
Well, it was, you know, it's just a two-page ruling, and it's what we would call a temporary injunction. So they're basically going to consider whether or not this action is constitutional in the future. But for now, they have ordered the government to put these stations back on the air effective immediately.
And is the government going to comply?
That's a big question. I just spoke to the lawyer who filed this lawsuit, and he told me he fully expects the government to comply. But I think one thing we have to remember is that we're, again, here in Kenya in uncharted territories. A crackdown of this kind had really not happened in Kenya since the authoritarian days of Daniel Arap Moi, basically since Kenya ushered in an era of multi-party democracy and an era of freedom of the press and freedom of speech. I mean, that is the important part of this story. I had a very surreal experience after the mock inauguration event of the opposition leader Raila Odinga. After it finished, I went for a walk downtown, and these two young guys came up to me, and you know they saw my press badge and my microphone, and they said, "What happened?" And that's not something that happens in Kenya. The government had shut down the television stations, so people had not been able to get the news. And, you know, this is an incredibly connected country. It's a country where people are politically active and they keep up with these events, you know, in very real and very granular ways. And so to hear that on the streets was very strange. It made me feel like I was in one of Kenya's neighbors, like Ethiopia or Uganda, where this does happen, but in Kenya it doesn't.
Well, to that point, let's listen here to Henry Maina, who is a press freedom activist in Kenya.
We need to know that this is a turning point. It's the lowest in the media history in the country. We can't just let it pass unless we want to die on our knees.
Eder, this all has to do with the two elections that were held last year. Remind us how Kenya got to this point.
So we've had two elections. Then we had two Supreme Court decisions. The first election was thrown out. The second election was upheld. And so now we've had two inaugurations. Of course, The second one, the one by Raila Odinga, opposition leader Raila Odinga, is not legal. It's not constitutional. And, you know, the reason we are here is because he believes that this government has stolen the elections from him. And, you know, during the first elections, the Supreme Court basically sided with Raila Odinga. They said that there were so many irregularities that they could not call those first elections constitutional. The second elections, Raila Odinga pulled out of them because he thought that the country hadn't made enough changes to make them free and fair. And they were marked by chaos and violence, and only about 30% of the country voted. So he thinks those elections don't count. He thinks that he won the first elections. And so he thinks that he is achieving electoral justice by declaring himself the president.
How much is all of this setting Kenya back or keeping the government from doing the things it's supposed to be doing for the people of Kenya?
The economy has been battered. There is no doubt about that. You know, growth has slowed investment has also slowed here in Kenya. And that's the big argument that the government makes. The government has been saying, we need to move on. Kenya needs to move on to do the important development work that that the government wants to do. The opposition will say, you know, there's nothing more important than to create a free and fair electoral system in this country. So, you know, they don't believe that the country should move on before it resolves this very core issue.
So what happens next?
We're not sure. The opposition leader gave a press conference today in which he said that, you know, he would give more details in the future. But right now, there's a lot of turmoil. There are, you know, one of the opposition lawmakers, the one who officiated this this inauguration, this mock inauguration, is now in jail. The government has said that they will continue to arrest other people, and they have declared a wing of the opposition party an organized criminal group. And they say that no matter where any of these people from this group are, they will arrest them. And the interior minister said that they would be, quote, very sorry.
That's NPR's East Africa correspondent Eder Peralta joining us from Nairobi, Kenya. Eder, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.